Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's been 7 years since Russian and Russian-backed forces invaded eastern Ukraine. Still today, 7 years later, it's a site of simmering skirmishes and artillery fire, and it's a potential world flashpoint, especially this winter as many observers expect Russia to use its natural gas exports as leverage on the region. My guest today is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night on Russia, Ukraine, and the Biden Doctrine. And he's also a familiar face to those who watched the first congressional impeachment testimony, Ambassador William Taylor. Taylor was the ambassador to Ukraine from 2006 to 2009, then returned to Kiev in the summer of 2019 following the recall of Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. As chargé d'affaires, he led the embassy and witnessed the dual policy coming from Washington, an official diplomatic policy and a back-channel policy from the Trump White House, demanding investigations of the then-former Vice President Biden and Biden family members. Ambassador Taylor has a long history serving the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, as well as the Mideast. He's currently the Vice President for Strategic Stability and Security at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ambassador Taylor, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
First, thank you for having me again.
You're going to be speaking on Russia, Ukraine, and the Biden Doctrine. I want to ask, just in your view, what is the long-term aspirations of Russia when it comes to Ukraine and the territories that were once a part of the Soviet Union?
Rich, I think the Russians, and I should say Mr. Putin, because he's not speaking for all Russians, but he's speaking for a lot of Russians.
He's speaking probably for the government.
He's certainly speaking for the government, and he dominates the government, and he has a big influence on what Russians think. So in answer to your question, what does he want? First of all, he's been explicit in the last 2 months about what he thinks about Ukraine. He wrote a 5,000-word piece that answers that question that you just asked, Rich. And his answer was, Ukraine is not a real country. Ukraine's really just part of the Russian nation. And therefore, he wants to reassemble the Russian lands of which he thinks Ukraine's part, and other parts of other sovereign nations. I mean, as we know, Ukraine is a sovereign nation. Belarus is kind of a sovereign nation. It's probably disappearing as we speak. But Ukraine is proudly independent, proudly sovereign, proudly a nation that goes back longer than the Russians. Mm-hmm. It goes back, the Ukrainian civilization really was the origin of both Ukraine and later Russia and later other parts of the Slavic world. So Ukraine's a real nation, and Mr. Putin doesn't accept that. So his view is that if Ukraine's not a real country and it's actually, they're just really little Russians, he calls Ukraine little.
A breakaway.
A breakaway, which will return to the fold. Ukrainians don't see it that way.
Well, and most of the rest of the world doesn't see it that way.
The rest of the world does not see it that way. And it makes the rest of the world nervous. You're right.
It makes the rest of the world nervous, but it's also something, I mean, I don't think Americans are interested in intervening. And most of the rest of the world is not really interested in intervening.
The only reason we're interested in what goes on there, well, there are several reasons. The main reason is we would like to see a stable, secure Europe, a stable, secure world, for that matter. If there's a nation, a large, powerful nation that has nuclear weapons, who doesn't abide by some rules of how nations interact, that's a problem. So Russia invading its neighbors, not just Ukraine, but most recently and most blatantly Ukraine, is a real problem for a stable, secure world. So we do care about that aspect.
Yeah. Now, how did that letter go over in Kiev?
Horribly. Outrageous. So Mr. Putin put out that document. His former prime minister, kind of Medvedev, put out a companion piece in some sense, who basically had the same line, as you would expect. Mr. Putin calls the shots. But Mr. Medvedev went even further to say, look, we're not even going to deal with the Ukrainians on this attempt to find a peaceful solution to the conflict, to the war that the Russians are waging against Ukraine and the West. We're not even going to try with this government in Ukraine, Medvedev said. We're just going to wait this guy out.
Interesting. And When I think of Ukraine, I really think of a sort of a red-blue divide between the factions of Ukraine that want to look to the West, and then there's the red faction or, you know, blue faction, whatever, whichever color you choose, but this other faction that does long to go back to Russia or at least have closer ties. And that's always been I've always read that's a tension in Ukraine.
It has been a tension.
I would imagine a letter like that maybe.
Not only the letter. What really has changed that divide, that tension, was the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014. Mm-hmm. Up until then, your description was unfortunately accurate. There was a divide in Ukraine. When I was there, I was in Ukraine from 2006 to 2009.
The government flipped back and forth between.
Government flipped back and forth between presidents who were oriented toward Russia, presidents who were oriented towards the West, toward Europe. And as a measure of how democratic the place was, and also how evenly balanced it, they went back and forth. They went exactly as you said. They went back and forth. However, in 2014, that changed, and the faction that was supporting or being willing to, even eager to associate with Russia, went way down, and the number of Ukrainians, the percentage of Ukrainians who said, Europe is the right direction, went way up. Mr. Putin hurt himself badly in Ukraine, not just for that letter most recently, but really for the invasion.
Yeah. What is the status of this conflict? Is it a simmering conflict where it's basically people taking pot shots at each other, or does it heat up from time to time?
It heats up from time to time. It was very hot, of course, in 2014, 2015. And thousands of Ukrainians and Russians died in that time. Since then, it has gone, the level of fighting, the number of casualties has gone way down, so that today, in answer to your question, it's, I would say, simmering. It's certainly not frozen, because people die every week. It's not hot. It's not, there's not regular fighting, but there are the pot shots, the artillery, the sniper fire that kill people, mainly from the Russian side, killing Ukrainian soldiers. A couple a week is what we're talking about now. Mm. Total of about 14,000 Ukrainians have died since that invasion in 2014.
Now, I remember when the invasion occurred, the Russian line was, this was pro-Russian Ukrainians fighting. Is there any sort of a fig leaf or pretense that, in fact, it is Russia that is fighting on the other side?
It is very clear that it's Russia fighting on the other side.
Do they even make that argument anymore?
Of course.
Oh, they still do.
Oh, they still do. Yeah. The fact is, in the negotiations at the Institute of Peace, where I work again, we're trying to encourage a negotiated end to that conflict. That's what we do. And in order to have a negotiation, you have to have two sides that kind of recognize themselves as parties to the conflict. The Russians won't do that. The Russians still won't do that. No, it's not us. It's those Ukrainians in Donbas, in Donetsk and Luhansk. And everybody knows that it's the Russians. Everybody knows it's the
Russians. Is it the Russian army or is it special forces?
During the very intense fighting, it was the Russian army. It was the Russian army, regular Russian units. It has always been Russian special forces. The current leaders, if you will, of these breakaway puppet regimes in Donetsk and Luhansk, in that part of southeastern Ukraine, are Russians for all intents and purposes. They're certainly controlled by, paid by, led by, influenced by, directed by the Russians. There's no doubt about this.
Mm. Well, this comes on the heels of some prolonged talks over the last year between Russia and Belarus. In fact, you said you see that the Belarus state is probably going to be absorbed at some point. I think they're talking about a merger. They're saying we're going to close up economically and we'll leave the political questions for now. Is a merger a foregone conclusion in your view?
I wouldn't say foregone. I would say likely. As we know, the Russians had a presidential election, which President Lukashenko, who's been in office for a long time, lost.
Yes.
He was defeated by Mrs. Tikhanovskaya, by all accounts. He didn't buy it. He changed the outcome, falsified the outcome. She had to flee. Mm-hmm. That has led to the current unrest. And that unrest has led Mr. Lukashenko to count more and more, depend more and more on Mr. Putin for backing and support. Otherwise, he's out. And so Mr. Putin is keeping him in. The understanding is Mr. Putin's not a big fan of Mr. Lukashenko, but he's keeping them in because Lukashenko keeps talking about what you just mentioned, Rich, that is this kind of union state, they call it, where gradually the distinction between Belarus and Russia will disappear. So in answer to your question, I would say that's certainly the direction that's going in. We can hope that that won't happen.
Either way, there's no advantage to the United States, is there?
There's not a big advantage to the United States one way or the other.
Belarus has been hostile to the United States.
It has been hostile. Now, the Belarusian people,
right?
We could be and are very sympathetic to them, and they're not necessarily pro-U.S. or pro-Europe, and they're kind of pro-Russian, but they're anti-Lukashenko. They're anti-Lukashenko.
He's been there a long time. He's corrupt.
He's been there too long. He's corrupt. He clearly stole this election like he did the previous ones, and they're tired of him. And so they just want to get along on their business. I mean, they're good entrepreneurs. They're good information technology, IT specialists. They could make it on their own.
Hmm. This last week, Russia decided to break diplomatic ties with NATO, which may come to a surprise to a lot of people that Russia did have diplomatic ties with NATO. And I think it was a way of sort of decreasing military tension over the long haul. Is this a significant decision?
I think it is significant, Rich. Back in the 90s, when Russia became a real country again, the Soviet Union disappeared in the early 90s, and Russia became independent, like Ukraine, like Belarus, like Armenia, like all these former Soviet states were new independent countries. Several of these countries, in the Baltics, for example, bolted immediately. They immediately went towards Europe. And now, of course, as we know, they're members of the EU and they're members of NATO. And there was an attempt at that time on the part of NATO to bring the Russians along. There was even the hope. I don't know how many people entertained this, though, but there were some people who had the hope, not without reason, that maybe the Russian people, Boris Yeltsin could come toward Europe, maybe even join NATO. They didn't get that far, clearly, but they did get as far as establishing a NATO-Russia Council back in the 90s. And that has met sporadically, and sometimes when the Russians misbehave, like when they invade their neighbor, they shut that, the NATO and the Russians shut that down, and there's nothing to be done. They've tried to reestablish that Russia-NATO Council, and they've maintained an office. The Russians have maintained an office in Brussels. It got to the point where, I guess about 2 months ago or so, the Belgian government and NATO said, those 9 people in that Russian delegation, they're really spies. You need to send them home. So they did. So they asked the Russians to leave. I think by the end of this month they have to go. And so then that led to what you said, Rich, that is the Russians saying, okay, we're out of there.
Yeah. My guest today is former Ambassador William Taylor. He was ambassador to Ukraine from 2006 to 2009. He came back as charge d'affaires at the embassy in 2019, a momentous year in the Ukrainian embassy, American embassy in Ukraine. He's currently the vice president for strategic stability and security at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He is a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on Russia, Ukraine, and the Biden Doctrine. Now, that came as a little bit of a surprise to me. I didn't know there was a Biden Doctrine. Or are you suggesting there should be a Biden Doctrine?
I'm suggesting, Rich, that there might develop a Biden Doctrine. President Biden, to be fair, has articulated a framework that he would like to see guide his foreign policy. And there are elements of this framework that, if pursued, if fleshed out, if specified, could develop into a doctrine. I mean, it's not yet there, but parts of that framework, the elements of that, include the contest between democracy and autocracy. And we can go into the discussion of that. There are other things. He has said that the United States should not engage in other people's civil wars. And, of course, we know that there was a civil war in Iraq, a civil war in Afghanistan, and other places. And we know the outcome certainly in Afghanistan. So those kinds of planks, if you will, those kind of elements of a framework for a foreign policy. And I suggested in an article earlier this year that if there is a Biden doctrine, and if democracy versus autocracy is an important component of that, and if we want to support democracies and show that we as the United States support our allies, then we should support Ukraine. Ukraine is right there on the front line of autocracy democracy.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, that idea of not getting involved in civil wars, that's difficult even when it's just two powers. And I think what's emerging in the 21st century is a multi-power world, where it's Russia, it's China, it's the United States. It's also players like Iran. It's players that maybe we haven't even really thought about that will emerge. Turkey, for that matter, you know, very strategic point, and they have aspirations. That becomes very difficult because you're kind of playing the great game. And it's a great tendency to try to, when, you know, there's a civil war, back one side or the other, maybe because the people you don't like are back on the other side.
And that multipolarity that you describe, there are a lot of different actors, also complicates a lot of what we used to do just with the Soviets in terms of arms control.
Yeah.
Back in 2010, 2011, when we signed the last big arms control agreement with the Soviets, it was a lot easier just to do it.
The Russians.
Now the Russians.
Right.
Thank you. But earlier we had done something with the Soviets.
Right.
Now we're doing, you're exactly. Now with the Russians in 2011. And now that we're taking a look at arms control again, because we had to extend that last one, the New START treaty, times are different. As you say, the Chinese now are big players. They weren't then. They weren't back 10 years ago. It was Russia and the United States. Now the Chinese. And then there are some kind of rogue nations that you've mentioned as well, North Korea, Iran, who are complicating the calculation. So there's a lot of different consider, not to mention new technologies. There are a lot of new technologies that are not covered by the old arms control treaties that are going to threaten stability, strategic stability, and that is a concern for us.
I just want to ask one last question about Russia, and that has to do with the great fear that seems to be emerging in Europe that Russia will use natural gas as prices rise as a weapon this winter. Do you think that's a possibility?
It's not only a possibility, it's a fact.
They will.
I think they are doing it now. I think they are doing it now. So as your question indicates, there is this pipeline, this new natural gas pipeline. It goes from Russia to Germany. It's called Nord Stream 2. And Nord Stream 2 pipeline was designed and built not for any economic reason, but in order to bypass Ukraine. There's plenty of space, plenty of room in big natural gas pipelines going across Ukraine, from Russia, across Ukraine, into Europe. But the Russians don't want to use that. They would rather build this pipeline under the sea from Russia to Germany in order to go around Ukraine and to get leverage on the Europeans, not just the Germans, but Europeans more broadly. And as we see today, they are using that leverage. They are using that as a weapon.
In what ways?
In that they are restricting natural gas supplies to Europe. So this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, very controversial. The Trump administration opposed it. The Biden administration opposed it. The Congress hates it, has passed sanctions against it. President Biden waived some of those sanctions that were imposed on the Nord Stream, allowing it to go forward. It was almost complete when he became president. Not quite, but he waived some sanctions that allowed it to proceed. It's now built, but it's not yet in operation. It's not, the regulatory checks are not all done. But the Russians are withholding gas that they could supply right across Ukraine to Europe to keep prices reasonable but they're not. They're letting prices rise, and they're saying, you know, if we had that Nord Stream 2 pipeline regulatory approvals, we could send you more gas. And the gas prices in Europe are very high. The Russians are clearly using that as a strategic weapon right now.
So it becomes a tactical weapon against the nations immediately surrounding Russia, because they can send the gas, bypass them, to the West, who is a ready customer, who will pay, versus the sphere surrounding Russia that, well, let's be frank, they've had less of a track record of paying for it, and it puts leverage on them to do Moscow's bidding.
It clearly puts leverage on them. So the Europeans now are very dependent on Russian gas, and this makes them even more dependent on Russian gas.
In our last 10 minutes or so, I'd like to talk about your role when you came back to Ukraine as the charge d'affaires in 2019, following the resignation of, actually the recall of Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. Was that a difficult decision to make, to go back in there, seeing that she was recalled and you were going to serve basically as acting ambassador, as head of the diplomatic mission? Was that a difficult decision?
It was. I was inclined not to do it. I was inclined not to say yes to the request from Secretary Pompeo. Consulted with a lot of people, including my wife. My wife thought this was a terrible idea. She for exactly the reasons, Rich, that you said. That is, she said, look what they've done to Masha Ivanovich. And this is, of course, this administration. I also consulted with some people who said, you know, there are two reasons that we need to have someone with your experience in Ukraine right now. One is because Masha was pulled out so abruptly, the embassy staff was left unaware, just discombobulated, confused. Why was our ambassador, whom they loved, pulled out so suddenly? And no explanation. So there was a real problem of morale in the embassy, number one. Number two, there was a brand new president of Ukraine. He had just been elected. He was putting in place new ministers, a new government, and the United States should be represented at that time. So there were two reasons that they really wanted somebody. So I did some consultations, talked to a lot of people, had a conversation with Secretary Pompeo, and went into that meeting inclined to say no. But he promised me that the U.S. policy of support for Ukraine would continue. I was worried, and what would have done it for me was if that policy of strong support for Ukraine would have changed because President Trump did not like Ukraine. And I told Secretary Pompeo that.
Yeah. Well, you got to Ukraine. How soon was it apparent that the White House interest in Ukraine was simply political gain, domestic political gain?
It emerged over the 3 months. So I arrived in June. Mm-hmm. There were some early signals that there was something amiss, that there was something else going on, what you said. That is, there was the main policy, the regular policy, the regular channel of information going back and forth between Ukraine and Washington. But I began to see over June, July, in July, and into August, the late August, there was another channel. I called it the irregular channel. And that was separate from the normal foreign policy of the United States. And it was run by Rudy Giuliani.
Mm. You obviously were one of the prime testimonies of the inquiry that led to the first impeachment. And you pretty much laid out that from what everyone was telling you, that there was a quid pro quo in effect. Aid would come if investigations were opened. That never happened. No investigations were opened. But what is the long-term effect of something like that, where the United States is basically saying, you have to do something for our political gain for us to do our diplomatic, our foreign relation responsibilities?
That was the biggest concern. That is, Ukrainians were being asked to do things that they knew were not right in order to do something that they needed. They're fighting the Russians. They're fighting the Russians every day out on the eastern part of their country. And we're supplying weapons to them. We're supplying military support, military assistance, training, and indeed weapons, lethal weapons. And that support, that assistance, security assistance, was being held up. It was actually on pause. It was stopped until unless these investigations took place. And again, this was done subtly and in code, and it was not part of, obviously it wasn't part of U.S. foreign policy, but it was part of this irregular channel. And the Ukrainians were confused. They didn't know what to make of this. And finally, when it became clear in September of 2019 what was actually happening, they were glad that they didn't get sucked in. And indeed, the assistance was released and came through, and the investigations did not happen.
Yeah. I remember at the time there was also the idea that President Zelensky would come to the United States. Obviously, that would have value for Ukraine in a fight against Russia, where there's an active simmering war going on. And of course, that never happened. But it did happen pretty early in the Biden administration. How important was that?
Very important. It's very important. Exactly what you said, Rich. That is, if both President Zelensky has the confidence that comes from a meeting with the President of the United States in the President of the United States office in Washington, D.C., his people, the Ukrainians, see that, and they gain confidence and pleased to see that Ukraine matters to the United States and to President Biden. And as important, the Russians see it. And this is a message to the Russians as well, that we care about Ukraine. We see Ukraine as being important to our own security, and we're willing to support them in several of these ways, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. So that's why that's such an important meeting.
I think often we see these as simply photo ops, a meeting, and we don't really think much about it. But for a country like Ukraine or many other places in the world, that meeting in the Oval Office bears tremendous symbolism, even today.
It's true, and there are not that many nations in the world whose presidents or prime ministers, whose leaders show up in the Oval Office. There are just not that many. There are probably two Europeans so far, Mrs. Merkel and President Zelensky. That was noticed. That's an important message. It's more than symbolism. It means things.
All right. Well, Ambassador Taylor, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Great to be here.
Ambassador William Taylor speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's currently the Vice President for Strategic Stability and Security at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and he's a former ambassador to Ukraine from 2006 to 2009, then returned to serve as Chargé d'Affaires at the embassy in 2019, the summer before the first impeachment of President Trump. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night on Russia, Ukraine, and the Biden Doctrine. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.